Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Major General Walter Piatt. General Piatt is the commander of the Army's 10th Mountain Division, based at Fort Drum. He's had deployments around the world and at the Pentagon and has extensive experience in Afghanistan. General Piatt was on the program last winter, prior to the division's deployment in Iraq in support of Operation Inherent Resolve. The division is now returned, and he's with me again today to talk about that mission and the situation in Iraq. General Piatt, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, let me start as I did last time, and that's by thanking you and, of course, all your troops for their service to the country. We appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
And let me ask you to begin, if we could, by giving our listeners a brief overview of the division's recent deployment in Iraq. You know, how many troops went? What locations in the country were you concentrated in, if any? What was the objective?
Yeah, in this particular deployment, it was our division headquarters. So it was only a little over 500 soldiers that deployed, some of them for the New York National Guard, too, that helped round out the division headquarters for the 10th Mountain Division. We had our 3rd Brigade, 10th Mountain Division, was already there. It's just how the Army does rotations and deployments. But this one was the headquarters. Our mission, I assumed command of the Coalition Joint Force Land Component Command. And our mission there was to deactivate that command as part of the progress to post-conflict, because Iraq had won the major fights against ISIS. So our mission there was to transition and set conditions for that transition over to more Iraqi control. And we were very successful in it very early on. By almost within 60 days were we able to inactivate the command and transition to the campaign plan that was called Reliable Partnership, then to advise and assist our Iraqi counterparts in areas not just in the tactical fighting and execution of military matters, but also in how they could rebuild their army and reestablish training and then allow the army then to become subordinate to the government as they took the lead role in post-conflict Iraq.
And you've written accounts in the past, published books based on your observations and your experiences in the Middle East in particular. And so you're a keen observer of what's going on. I want to tap that in our conversation here today. So maybe it's impossible to generalize in the way I'm going to ask you to try in this first question. But let's say I were to go outside of Baghdad now into the country. What kind of place would I encounter in terms of basics like water, food, electricity, healthcare, housing? What would I be seeing and encountering?
Well, there is a wide variety. First of all, Baghdad is a very safe and secure city. It's the capital. And the ISIS never made it to the capital. They were 20 kilometers away. So the rest of the country, you'll still see the scars of war and occupation of ISIS. And that also serves as a symbol to the people of how bad it was. And there's immediate hope and faith that they have overcome such a terrible enemy that now they can do anything that is presented before them. But as that time goes past, there's a demand for basic services. You know, we want to have water. How can a nation as wealthy as Iraq not be able to provide my town water? I think some local folks you would see. But you'll see good people that have survived the devastation of a horrible, horrible conflict and are trying to rebuild post-war in their little towns and villages throughout. But I still say that you see, first of all, hope, because this attack from ISIS, although, you know, they threatened to take over Iraq itself, it solidified Iraq. The response was one of unity of the Iraqi people to defeat this enemy. And not only defeating it for Iraq, this helped the world, because this was an enemy that could present, you know, external attacks on every home country or homeland of the coalition, which were many, many different countries there. So what Iraq did was not only important for Iraq, obviously, it was also important for the world, because this was a global terror threat. So you see hope, but also people are running out of patience. It's very fair to say that they want to see the benefits of the war that they fought so hard to win.
And you've written a report based on your mission. It's titled Winning the Peace in Iraq. And you write in that report that, and you've kind of alluded to it just there in your answer, but that once the threat of ISIS was broken up militarily, then there were other challenges that, you know, you start to see more clearly. And one of them that you describe is these older forces of social and political divisions in Iraq that were there before and now they've reemerged. What are some of the most significant of those internal divisions?
Yes, I think first off, I always tell myself, wars don't end in peace. That peace is a process that is often a more difficult struggle than war itself. War united Iraq. So when the enemy that united Iraq, ISIS, was military defeated, tactically they were defeated, and they fled. And this success came at such a rapid pace once the fall of Mosul happened. ISIS almost disintegrated. Now, they're on the run hiding, but they defeated them as a military front, but they did not defeat the ideology. The ideology still lingers. And so old issues began to arise, as you mentioned, because now there wasn't a unifier of an enemy that was unifying the country. Mm. I think all of them are very significant, and all of them require a long, difficult process to try to build consensus to overcome. So you have militia groups that are still mobilized. They were critical in the victory over ISIS, but yet they could be working against the peace they helped to fight for. You have the terrible destruction of Mosul and the terrible destruction of many cities scarred by ISIS occupation. And then you have the divide between Kurdistan and Iraq and the disputed territories. These were issues long before even the U.S. time in Iraq, and now they're coming to a head, and these are very important political issues. Who's going to benefit? How are they going to benefit? Or the country's going to benefit from oil revenues and provide water and resources to the population who deserve it. So you win the fight, everybody's ecstatic and happy, but then these issues come, and it's a difficult challenge. It's easy to say, oh, they just need to take care of these things. But you can imagine the devastation after Hurricane Katrina or any natural disaster in our nation, how the most powerful government in the world is slow to respond to our population that is in need because the devastation is so great. This is what's happening in Iraq. And I think it's fair that they're determined. They want to rebuild. They want to take care of the population. But you have a convergence of political agendas that they're not all bad. It's just that how will you compromise and on these agendas while providing for the best of the people?
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with General Walter Piatt, commander of the Army's 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum. Let me get into some of these different divisions, and you write about them in your report. I was at a presentation recently by an expert on Turkey, and he said something that really grabbed my attention, and then you wrote something that grabbed my attention. He said that the Kurds were the ethnic group occupying the largest territory in the world without a state of their own. So that they have this particular position they occupy at the top in the world, I guess, of one that you wouldn't want to have. And that territory extends, of course, across several different national boundaries. So How would they ever get their own state under those conditions? If you've got this large territory and you don't have a state attached to it, and it expands over four, five, six different countries, how do you ever get your own country?
Yes, the Kurds, they do. The groups expand well over Syria, Turkey, Iran, Iraq, northern Iraq. And they're separate groups within the Kurds as well. It's not one unified group.
Right.
It's an incredibly complex issue. The U.S. policy is one Iraq, and the Kurds are within the borders of Iraq, and there are several groups that are within that. And they see their future. They participated in the elections. They participated, and they have now a president that's Kurdish, and some of the key political offices post-election are Kurds. There are many senior military officers that are Kurdish. It's an integrated country. There are still those who want to lean more towards independence. That's an internal issue within Iraq itself. It's a difficult one. But what the divide that we see post-conflict is that these old issues started to come to the forefront again. That there were disputed territories. There are methods for this of how they would reconcile these disputes in the Constitution that have been deferred for many years. So they recognized the need that they were going to have to do census and then move forward and just to determine the future of these disputed territories along the Kurdish regional or the coordination line in the Kurdish region. So much like a state within the United States would have a dispute on the border. This is where they are. Some of those will be resolved politically and legitimately, and there's a good process for that. But there are others who would probably want to push for more independence. But it's not a one autonomous region across those many countries. Most of them, they view themselves as belonging to the country that they're currently in, and they're divided from others. But in Kurdistan, there is a government as part of the Iraqi constitution. They do have a regional government that's elected, and they help govern the northern provinces of Iraq. It's a difficult way ahead because at stake is Kirkuk, and Kirkuk is a disputed city. Not that who should own it, although there are those who would argue that. It's just that Kirkuk is very rich, and it's a multi-ethnic city. It has it has Kurds and Turkmen and Arabs, and they're able to get along and govern. And I've met with many of them, and they want a chance to resolve this peacefully and to share and to understand. This is generational for them. They didn't move in and try to tip the balance of the population one way or another. They've been there for generations. They want to coexist peacefully. They believe they can. This will be a long, difficult diplomatic solution, but what's at stake is a good portion of Iraq's oil reserves. It's a good way that can unify the country and bring prosperity to Iraq, or if the arguments don't get resolved peacefully, it could keep Iraq, working towards it. It could prevent the peace that Iraq fought so hard to achieve. This is a very difficult situation. As I said, the peace is harder than winning the fight.
And you had something in your report that really caught my attention on exactly this point. It's that you wrote, if the government of Iraq is unable to resolve the tensions with the Kurds, and you've just talked about some of those, and then the tensions within the different Kurdish groups, and you alluded to that as well, you write, international intervention may be required. And that really leapt out at me, of course. What intervention do you envision there, particularly from the United States? What do you think may be necessary in the end?
I think my best military advice to many of the Iraqi senior military leaders that I was advising and helping with was that just because you've won the fight doesn't mean international and coalition forces should leave Iraq. It was a lesson that many senior Iraqis would tell you last time, that the asking the U.S. and the U.S. leaving too soon and many coalition support leaving was wrong. We need that presence to help us get through these very difficult political issues. That presence helps keep the security at bay, helps build the military while we get to work on these issues. So that presence is really the NATO training mission that's coming over right now. These are all peaceful interventions of the international community to help the difficult diplomatic process that's required. The Iraqi army does not need our security forces. They are very professional. They won a great victory against a terrible enemy. They are professional and trusted. I would trust many of their leaders with my very life. They are very good, and they know, and they're well trusted by the Iraqi people. They're the highest organization in the country when you poll the population of trust. They see Iraqi army now, they trust them. The Iraqi army trusts the United States and the international community because they saw we did not walk away when their country was threatened by ISIS and almost overrun. We stayed there. We committed resources. We advised, assisted, and accompanied them on difficult combat missions to win this fight. They don't want us to walk away as they now struggle to win the peace.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Major General Walter Piatt, commander of the Army's 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum, and we're discussing the division's recent deployment into Iraq in support of Operation Inherent Resolve. A different potential problem now for the Iraqis. Many observers of Iraq have identified the exclusion of the Sunnis as one of the mistakes, perhaps, that the United States made and its allies in the original invasion of the country and the installation of a new government there. And in your report on your recent mission, you suggest that the situation with the Sunnis has been complicated by the fact that the Sunnis were also integral to the defeat of ISIS. And so now they may feel even more marginalized by the government. So what do you think the government of Iraq needs to do regarding them, and how might it go about doing that?
Well, the Sunnis are integrated. I think this time around, the leadership of Iraq realizes what's at stake. And I can speak very clearly, because I had many moments with Prime Minister Abadi and with the senior military officers. They understand that they almost lost their entire country. They saw it firsthand, and it unified them. And there is a strong will, and you can see it in their eyes, that this can never happen again. That we have to put away, you know, our small differences in order for a greater country. And it's sad that that war happened, but one of the good things that came from this was a unified Iraqi response, and I think now that response goes forward as they govern the country. Many of my friends that I know personally, that are Iraqi friends of mine, are Sunnis, and they are government leaders in Tikrit and in Saladin. And there was an initial wave post-conflict because ISIS occupied those territories, and as the Iraqi army moved in, there was always doubt on who was helping the ISIS occupiers and who was just a victim of it. So it was unclear. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult in any population. So many of them felt, you know, the government was slow to respond to include them back in. But we see it's happening. I mean, the elections were conducted in May. It was fair. It was celebratorial. There were minor instances. I mean, the country was very peaceful that day. So I think there's hope, but they must be included. They must continue to get into that political dialogue. The army is very integrated, which is a good sign. That is a good institution. The rest of the political offices and country needs to take the lead from the military and integrate so that there's fair representation. But that won't happen overnight. I'm not naive in suggesting that it's an easy fix, but I think there's a determination that they must be inclusive, because if they're not, they will once again be divided.
And you've mentioned a couple times now how the military is one of the more respected institutions there now, and that it's doing things that, as you just suggested there, you know, the government and other institutions should be looking at and taking some lessons from. One possible future, though, that one might see for Iraq is perhaps military rule. What's your sense of that? Is that something that the United States and its influence would be able to kind of put the brakes on if that's where the country kind of started going?
Yeah, I don't get that sense from working with Iraqi Iraqi military. One of the things I think they took from the Western militaries and the coalition members and from the United States is what a professional army looks like, that we respect and subordinate ourselves to our civilian leadership, government leadership. But yet that doesn't mean we're going to not say no to them. It doesn't mean we're not going to stand up and present better options to our government leaders. But when the decision's made, we'll execute. That was part of reliable partnership. We built a very good army. So when Iraq was overrun by ISIS, the army disintegrated and fled. And they took great criticism for that. But it was the same army. It was the same leaders that mobilized the country again and counterattacked and defeated ISIS all the way up the country and all the way to Mosul and isolated Mosul, and then finally defeated the last big stand of ISIS in Mosul. It was the same people. Mm. They fought this together, and they fought alongside coalition members in U.S., and they saw the commitment of the U.S. So they have this deep trust now that this can work. The military has a responsibility to protect the homeland, but we also have a responsibility to make sure that our government doesn't overextend its power either. So I think we have, my way of saying, we have a professional military in Iraq, and I think that is a result of the many, many years of hard sacrifice and commitment on behalf of the United States and the coalition. That much we're very confident in. It has been a huge success, but at great cost. And I think they're in their position now where they're not sitting back idly. They are giving their best military advice, as do our senior military leaders do to our political leadership. We are subordinate to our civilian leadership, but we are obligated to give our best military advice. And I think that is it's not seen, it's not written about much, but when you're there, it's clearly evident.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is the commander of the Army's 10th Mountain Division based at Fort Drum, General Walter Piatt. Now, when it comes to Iraq, I think Iran is kind of like the 900-pound gorilla in the room. Iran has a very strong presence in Iraq, heavy influence in Iraq, everything I've read anyway. But our own relations with Iran are, of course, very problematic. So how does that challenge get worked out? If we're trying to have an influence on Iraq's future, Iran's there, they're influential, we have our set of problems with Iran. How do you sort that out?
I think the Iraqis say it the best, and Prime Minister Abadi has said this, we're not going to become a battleground for the U.S. and Iran. We're going to be Iraq. And I think that's what the United States clearly sees. There is a great possibility here that Iraq becomes this free, prosperous country in the heart of the Middle East that is very westward-leaning. Iran is their neighbor. They're going to trade with them. But Iranians come over all the time. There's going to be tourism and trade and agricultural trade. And because they're there, they're not going to go away. It'd be like moving Canada or Mexico away from us and the influence that they have, proximity to towns across their border. That, I think, is very possible. And I think that there's no way that Iraq's future must take into account all of its neighbors. They have to be good neighbors for that region, and they can be ones that can lead the region to prosperity because Iraq is a very natural resource, wealthy country that if it's governed and they can take care of their population, they can also export and add to some of the economic stability of the region and not take away from. But post-conflict, it's very difficult. And what I from being there, I never felt threatened by other nations. There's national influences, obviously, because they're there. I always felt confident that Iraq's army could defend internally within its borders. And that's one of our missions, is to build an Iraqi security force that could secure the homeland and internal borders of Iraq. And I think that mission is very much accomplished in the professional military we've built. I think we have to understand that they will always be their neighbors. And if we're going to build a regional security and regional stability, all the issues and all the differences have to now be looked at diplomatically and with whatever political compromise is going to be within the policies of the U.S. But now the conditions are there for that discussion to happen.
I want to try to squeeze a couple more questions in on a somewhat different topic. But before I do that, I think our listeners probably are curious about this report. Where might they go to find it or find it in the future?
Well, because you asked, we'll put it on our 10th Mountain webpage. I'll hang it there, and we'll advertise how you can get access
to
it. We did write some other papers just to bring in the community of people that were interested in building peace in post-conflict Iraq, and because winning the peace is so much harder than winning the fight. And militaries were good at the fight. But winning the peace, we're no longer the only player or the person in charge. We need the international community. We need non-governmental organizations. We need the organizations of the government. And this problem is so big that Iraq can't do it on their own. This is difficult. War is very difficult, but peace is very, very problematic. It takes longer. You have to rebuild from the destruction of war. You've got to bring people home, rebuild communities so they can feel safe after they were almost obliterated from ISIS. They try to obliterate entire cultures and minority cultures in the Nineveh Plains. This is a very difficult. These scars from this war will take a long time to heal. But that's why winning the peace is the only way to finally defeat the ideology of ISIS. Beating them militarily is not enough. If the other issues post-conflict are not addressed, you set conditions for the next enemy to come back and present this threat again, and therefore the fighting did not accomplish what we set out to do.
So I wanted to ask you a couple questions now more about Fort Drum. As we mentioned last time, I think we talked, you know, your troops have been deployed in this region quite a lot since 9/11. I think you're the most deployed division in that regard. So I'm wondering whether there must be some feeling on the base there of, you know, when are these sets of engagements going to end for us? And so how do you sustain the morale of your colleagues and the troops and the sense of mission under conditions like that? I would think that would be hard.
Well, the sun never sets on the 10th Mountain Patch. We are everywhere all the time. We are the most deployed division in the Army. I call us the blue-collar division for the United States Army. We do windows, and we get asked to do a lot. Our soldiers are ready. The reason they're so – the morale is high, and they're ready to respond to hurricane disasters in a moment's notice. So they're ready to deploy to Afghanistan, Iraq, Africa, many nations, is because they live in a great community. Their children, their families have access to good schools, and they have a good home on the base to live. Mm-hmm. And they're part of a division that knows how to train and prepare for any operation that could be given to us. We don't get to pick the mission, but what we do get to pick is how we accomplish it. And our soldiers feel good about that. And that's why I say, you know, 10th Mountain Division lives in the greatest military community in the United States. Now, I'm a little biased, but it makes a difference. When you get along with your community and the small town surrounding us, in this universe, Syracuse University, the way they treat us, the way they respect our soldiers, that gives you great pride in what you're doing. Our nation welcomes us home. We walk in airports with our uniform on. People buy us a cup of coffee. They thank us for what we're doing. Everywhere I go, I'm thanked for my service. That is tremendous respect from our nation, and that's what we do it for. And that's why the morale is very high. But there is it's a fair question, you know, how does this end? When is, you know, will we ever achieve peace? And why we write about winning the peace is winning the peace is just as important to a soldier as winning the fight. Winning the peace is harder. Wars don't end in peace. This peace is a struggle. And people need to know that our country's always been one that would commit great resources and time and sacrifice to other nations so they could build prosperity post-conflict, and that will achieve lasting victory over a terrible enemy.
That was General Walter Piatt. General, again, thank you for your service, and thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.